Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Thank you for coming to this video information webcast. My name is Benjamin Chi. I am with Nira Economic Consulting. Nira is the procurement administrator on behalf of the Illinois Power Agency. Presenting with me today is Mr. Anthony Starr from the Illinois Power Agency, as well as Dr. Chantal Lacasse from Nira as well. Today's webcast is for the initial forward procurement for RECs from wind and solar resources. This competitive bidding process is also known as the wind and solar RFP. This is for the procurement of RECs for three of the utilities that are named here, and I will mention them. Their logos are right at the bottom of this page, and we'll use these short names throughout the presentation as well. So just take note, AIC for the Ameren Illinois company, we'll use the short name ComEd for the Commonwealth Edison company, and MEC for the Mid-American Energy company. Again, this is a procurement for the IPAs, initial forward procurement, and Nira is the procurement administrator. One housekeeping item as we start here, we have this slide for instructions on how you can ask questions to the presenters. You can ask questions at any time during this webcast. To do so, simply locate the Q&A on the right side of your screen, the Q&A icon, and select all panelists in the ask box. Type in your questions, reference any page or slide numbers, and click send to submit your questions. We have provided here as well the URL for the procurement website, which is ipa-energyrfp.com. This presentation, as well as any Q&As, will be posted to the procurement website shortly after this webcast as well. For today's agenda, I will walk you through briefly the regulatory background so you have a context for this procurement event. We will talk about and provide you an overview of the process, as well as walk you through the terms of the transaction by way of describing the supplier contracts to you. And then we will shift gears to talk about the practical aspects of the process, how you will submit to the requirements of this RFP process, the deadlines associated with the RFP process, as well as what a bid looks like, how you will submit your bids to us, and the post-bid process. So this process started since last year on December 7 of 2016, when Public Act 99-0906 was signed into law. And this Public Act became effective June 1st of this year. Pursuant to Public Act 99-0906, the IPA is to develop a long-term renewable resources procurement plan. In the interim, while the plan is being developed and pending approval by the Illinois Commerce Commission, the Act provides for an initial forward procurement, which is what this webcast is about. The initial forward procurement is for the procurement of 1 million RECs to be delivered annually from new utility-scale wind projects, as well as 1 million RECs to be delivered annually from new utility-scale solar projects, as well as brownfield site photovoltaic projects. The contract term is for 15 years. In particular, it's for 15 years of delivery of RECs. The initial delivery of RECs cannot occur earlier than June 1st, 2019, and cannot occur later than June 1st, 2021. For the new utility-scale wind resources, the Public Act envisages that there will be one procurement event, while for the utility scale solar as well as brownfield site photovoltaic resources, we're looking for multiple procurement events or multiple solicitations. In terms of the sources of information, first of all, as I have mentioned earlier, once the procurement event has started as of today, the procurement website is where you can find the RFP rules, the REC contract, the deadlines for key events, as well as announcements. So that is what is found on the left side of your screen. The URL again is ipa-energyrfp.com, and importantly, if you look at the left navigation bar, you will find what is circled there in red currently, the sublink that is known as wind and solar, which is used interchangeably by us at this point for the initial forward procurement for wind as well as for solar resources. And today's presentation is to explain the requirements of the wind and solar RFP. Again, at this time, the key information that you should be looking for will be found on the procurement website, which is found on the left side, for which the screenshot is found on the left side of this presentation, slide 5. So here I will provide you, starting on slide 7, an overview of the RFP process as well as the main terms of the contract. One quick and high-level announcement is that for this first round of the initial forward procurement, we are looking for RECs from both wind and solar resources. We are looking as pursuant to the Public Act for one procurement event, and this is it, for wind resources, for 1 million RECs to be delivered annually under a 15-year delivery contract. For the solar resources, we're looking to procure 200,000 RECs, which is 20% of the target for this first round. For this first round, the bid date is set at August 31st, the end of August 2017. At a high level, the RECs must be from new projects, new utility-scale wind projects, as well as new utility-scale solar projects or brownfield site photovoltaic projects. These RECs are unit-specific or unit-contingent. It must be RECs from these projects that are selected through the RFP. Through this RFP, you will name the price that you want to be paid for each REC that comes out of your winning project. You will also be required to name an annual quantity of RECs that you are committed to deliver under the REC contract. And importantly, the RECs from your winning projects, while you are putting in a proposal to this RFP with a price and an annual quantity, which is an output from your project, the RECs from the winning project itself will be allocated among the three utilities, the AIC for ComEd and for MEC. So under the program, under this RFP pursuant to the initial forward procurement, we have both project requirements, given that this must be from new resources, and we'll explain what it means, as well as from specific projects that meet specifications pursuant to the law. And then there are also product specifications, which I will go over on the next slide, slide 9. So on slide 8 here, I list out some of the project-specific requirements, most of which can be found in the law. So first, they must meet one of the resource types. We are only after utility scale solar projects, which must be greater than 2 megawatts or 2,000 kilowatts in nameplate capacity. This is in the AC rating. Or they must meet the resource type of a utility scale wind project, which is also with a nameplate capacity of greater than 2 megawatts, AC rating, or brownfield site photovoltaic projects. These must be new projects, meaning that they must be energized or have a date of first operation as recorded in GATS or AMRITS that occurs after June 1st of 2017. They must not be units or generating units whose costs are recovered through rates in Illinois or rates that are regulated by another state. They must be located in Illinois or an adjoining state if they are located in an adjoining state or adjacent state. They must meet specific public interest criteria. And under the contract, you must provide a site description through this RFP process, and 50% of the project itself must be located on the identified site. And for solar photovoltaic projects, meaning those projects that are for the, of the resource type utility scale solar or brownfield site photovoltaic projects, the installation must be installed by a qualified person. In terms of product requirements, there are certain requirements specified in the contract that you should be aware of. We are after standard RECs that must meet the definition of what a renewable energy credit means under the IPA Act as defined in the law, and it must include all environmental attributes. These RECs that you deliver must be from the projects that are selected as winning projects through the RFP. You must register the project with GATS or MRATS, and you will be delivering your RECs to the buyer's GATS or MRATS account in an unretired state. The RECs that you deliver must allow buyer, which is EIC, ComEd, and MEC, to comply with the Illinois RPS, meaning that the RECs themselves or the product must be regulatorily continuing, as the term is used in the REC contract. In terms of the first REC delivery, this must occur no earlier than June 1st, 2019. So it doesn't mean that your projects cannot be built earlier than that. You can build your projects as long as it's new, meaning that the first date in which it is energized or the date of first operation occurred after June 1st, 2017. But for payment purposes and for delivery purposes, the utilities can only accept your REC deliveries at the earliest on June 1st, 2019. And under the contract, your first REC delivery to the utilities must be by June 1st, 2021, no later than June 1st, 2021. And under the RFP, we are looking for one proposal per project. So if you have multiple projects, then you have to submit as many proposals under the RFP for each of the projects that you have. Under this construct, there is going to be a two-part process, two-part qualification and registration process, meaning that in part one, you will respond to the qualification standards. This is sometimes known as a pre-qualification process or a part one proposal process. And in this first part, the part one process, the window is between July 20th through through noon on August 7. It's an online process where you provide information using an online form. You complete these standalone documents known as inserts. You will then, in some cases, after you have completed them, print them out, sign them, scan them, and upload them back to the application website. The application website may also require you to provide supporting documents. And the only piece that is not an online process for the part one process is the submission of what we call the bid participation fee directly to the IPA. The part two process is similarly an online process where you will have to provide and certify to information using the online part two form. You will have to complete, print, sign, scan, and upload some of these standalone inserts. And the only thing that is not a part of the online process is the submission of your bid assurance collateral in the form of cash or a pre-bid letter of credit to the utilities by the deadline of noon on August 23rd. After that point, you'll have a chance to practice all aspects of bid submission, and then the bid date itself is on August 31st. In terms of bid submission, it's quite basic. Two takeaways here. Bids are submitted using an Excel spreadsheet that will be provided from us to you. You will use that spreadsheet to enter your bid information, and then you will transfer your spreadsheet through an electronic secure file transfer interface, instructions for which we will provide to you when you qualify pursuant to a successful Part 1 process. Once we have received your bids, we will consider bids that meet or beat the benchmarks that are developed by us, the procurement administrator, in consultation with the procurement monitor and approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission. And then evaluation will be selecting the winning bids separately for wind and solar resources and evaluated principally on a price-only basis. I will talk about the bid participation fee here, and then I will talk about the supplier fee next. These two fees, the bid participation fee and the supplier fee, is to cover the cost for the administration of the procurement process. So the bid participation fee, I'll tell you what the requirements are first, and how to proceed. So the bid participation fee is in the amount of $500. It's required of bidders that are participating in the initial forward procurement as your first procurement event in 2017. So if you have participated in prior procurements in 2017 in the spring, for example, the distributed generation RFP or the standard products RFP for block energy, you would have paid that $500 then. You don't need to do so again. If you're participating for the first time, the bid participation fee is a per bidder fee for all projects. So you just need to pay that once for entry. This is due to us with your part one proposal by the part one date, which is noon on August 7. There are two methods for payment. You can pay that using a physical check payable to the Illinois Power Agency or through an e-check. Or you can ask us for more detailed information by email to us at illinois-rfp@mira.com. For the supplier fee, this is not paid by all bidders. Importantly, this is paid only if you have winning projects. So only if you have been awarded a contract, you have been notified that you have won in the RFP, then this is applicable to you. Supplier fees are paid for winning projects only. Supplier fees are paid to the IPA within 7 business days of the ICC decision. We will provide you the final supplier fees amount no later than on August 29, which is no later than 2 business days prior to the bid date. But at this time, the estimates that we have is that it will be estimated at $1 times the annual quantity of RECs that you will indicate in your as part of your bid information. This translates to approximately 7 cents per REC across the 15-year of delivery of RECs. In terms of the REC contract, I will note here that the REC contract has been open to a supplier comment process. We have concluded that process and have issued the final contract to be used for this procurement event yesterday, July 18. You can find them on the website right now. Those are the governing documents. That contract is standard. It is not negotiable at this point in time. To participate in this initial forward procurement event, you must agree to the terms of the standard REC contract. So here is the disclaimer. Any statements that we make on this call or in the presentation that you see that describes or refers to the REC contract or the REC contract documents, they are summaries only, and they are qualified in their entirety by a reference to the REC contract documents. The REC contract documents, again, have been posted yesterday on the procurement website, and you, the bidders, will bear the full responsibility for reviewing and understanding the contract documents. In terms of the structure of the REC contract, we have gone through, this is 3 workshops prior to this webcast on the REC contract itself. I will provide a high-level summary of the key terms, and here the structure of the REC contract, it's a single document for which there are various exhibits appended to the end. The front part of the document, the front 18 or 19 pages, is what we call the cover sheet of the REC contract. The cover sheet is the main body, and it will be based on what we call the Master REC Agreement, which is the AVA-EMA call REC Purchase and Sale Agreement. The Master REC Agreement itself is appended as Exhibit D. We have other exhibits, as I had mentioned. Exhibit A contains an example on how you calculate your delivery year requirement, which is your delivery obligation under the contract for each delivery year. Exhibit B provides the standard guarantee form for each of the companies. And Exhibit C provides the options for letter of credit forms to be used under the REC contract. The cover sheet itself provides for specific terms related to the project requirements, product specifications, delivery and payment obligations, and timing for when certain things are due. In terms of the cover sheet, you'll find a table 1 embedded at the front of the REC contract with pricing and quantity details to be inserted based on the amount that you win in this RFP. The cover sheet itself, as well as I have mentioned, it is a document that will contain modifications to the Master REC Agreement. So while the standard Master REC Agreement is an industry standard document appended to the end of the REC contract in Exhibit D, the modifications to the standard agreement is actually made up front in the cover sheet. So the way that the contract interacts with the RFP, we have one slide here, is quite an important slide so that you understand how your bids are translated then into the contract. So through the process, that's the top part of this page, you will indicate to us through the RFP your purchase price and the number of racks to be delivered annually from your specific project. If you win, you must be willing to sign the contract. Currently, the contract is standard, as the terms have been harmonized across the three utilities. You must be willing to sign the REC contract with all three utilities. The contract itself is a bilateral contract. It's between you and each of AIC, ComEd, and MEC. The IPA is not a counterparty to the contract. You sign the contracts, there are three of these contracts. There are only two parties to each of these contracts. So just take note, the annual quantity that is from your project through the RFP will then be allocated by the procurement administrator for purposes of the REC contract. And importantly, the price in each of the REC contracts will be the same. So you name your price, you name a quantity for an annual delivery basis. That quantity from your project that has been awarded will then be allocated across the utilities. And the annual quantities across the utilities must sum up to the annual quantity that you have provided in your bid and offered from your winning project. There is this term known as the maximum contract quantity is basically the annual quantity found in each of the utility contract times 15 for the 15 years of delivery. So this example here at the bottom of slide 17 illustrates that a bidder bids and wins for its project to deliver 100,000 racks annually. And this 100,000 racks is then allocated with 35,000 racks annually to AIC, 50,000 racks annually to ComEd, and 15,000 racks annually to MEC, with the same price of $10 per racks across all three utility contracts. So here on slide 18, we have the timing terminology that is used in the contract. So we have the term of the agreement that incorporates a development phase for you to build your project. And once it is built and interconnected and the registration process is complete with GETS and MRETs, you will deliver your first, you will then be issued a first REC of the project by GETS or MRETs. That's the start of the delivery term. This part of the delivery term is regardless of when you actually deliver your REC to the buyer's account. As long as a first REC is issued by GETS or MRETs for the project, that's the start of the 15-year clock, known as the delivery term. The caveat to that is that the delivery term can start at the earliest June 1, 2019. If your project has been issued a first REC earlier than that, then the delivery term will start on June 1, 2019 and run 15 years thereafter. The date of the first REC delivery, the first REC that is delivered into the buyer's account under a REC contract must occur no later than June 1st, 2021. In terms of other timing considerations, at a very high level, just take note that your delivery obligations are accounted for on a delivery year basis and monthly payment and invoicing requirements are envisaged under the contract. So I'll tackle the first point here, which is that the delivery term, the 15-year delivery term, is divided into what we call delivery years. A delivery year starts on June 1st of a year, runs through May 31st of the following year. And your obligation to deliver racks, how we account for whether you meet the delivery obligations or not, is on a delivery year basis. And the second point is that invoicing and payment requirements are on a monthly basis. So for each month that you deliver racks, it is known as a delivery month. Right after each delivery month, you may invoice the buyer within or by the first 10 days of the subsequent month. So after you have delivered your racks, the 10th day after that delivery month is when invoices are due to buyer, and the buyer will then pay for the delivered racks by the end of that month upon receipt of your timely delivery of your invoice. So let's talk about delivery obligations very quickly. Delivery obligations are again accounted on a delivery year basis. The term that you will find in the contract is known as this term, the delivery year requirement. The delivery year requirement basically is the annual quantity under the contract. This is true for most years. I will sort of flesh out sort of two nuances for you. So first is that we do adjust for the delivery year requirement so that it is not the annual quantity for the first year and the last year, more precisely for the first and last delivery years. They will be prorated if the delivery term does not begin nicely on June 1st and does not therefore end on May 31st, 15 years after. So for those situations where you have a delivery term that starts off cycle, then your first delivery year and your last delivery year will be prorated based on the number of days in that delivery year that is included in a delivery term. That's the first thing you should note. The second thing to note is that we provide for some flexibility so that the requirement that you must meet is reduced and can be reduced up to 50% of the baseline requirement for the first 365 days to help you deal with any startup problems. In case you have your project up and running, but the project fails to produce as many racks as you have envisaged in the first 365 days, we have provide some flexibility for that. And to be more clear, the way that you can calculate your delivery year requirement, we have provided an example in the contract. This is found in Exhibit A to the REC contract that walks you through how the delivery year requirement is calculated. That is the requirement that you must meet in each delivery year. And basically, it is an event of default if you miss the delivery year requirement in any three or more delivery years, and the amount of the shortfall equals or exceeds the annual quantity. At that point, you will lose your collateral requirement, and I'll explain what this collateral requirement is, and the contract for that utility will be terminated. Besides the first year where we allow you to meet a lower threshold of up to 50% reduction in your baseline requirement, you have another flexibility that we provide so that it will allow you to manage your delivery obligations. So this is captured in the very flexible vintage specification under the REC contract. So the very flexible vintage definition will allow you, for lack of a better word, to bank your racks for future years. And basically, the vintage definition is this. We allow you to deliver your racks to buyer in any delivery year as long as the Rex importantly allow buyer to comply with the Illinois RPS. Again, this product is a regulatorily continuing product. If it does not allow buyer to comply with the RPS, it is no good for the buyer. Second, these RECs must be from the project itself that is selected through the RFP. We are not looking for replacement RECs to fulfill any shortfall that you may face in any delivery year. But having said that, your RECs need not be from the same delivery year. As long as the RECs are based on electricity generation anytime in the 15-year delivery term, as well as 2 additional months up front, you can use these RECs to meet your delivery obligations. To be more clear, you can use the RECs that were issued to you in the first delivery year to meet your 15th year delivery obligations. This is allowed. So this is a flexibility that allows you to meet your delivery obligations under the REC contract. Any excess RECs above and beyond that are produced by your project beyond the delivery year requirement in a delivery year is your property. You can sell it elsewhere, you can transfer it, you can keep it, importantly, for banking purposes. So the bottom of this slide 20 here, here we are letting you know that in each year, buyer cannot pay you more than the delivery year requirement except for the last delivery year. So if in a delivery year you have a shortfall in the future, you can use those RECs that you have saved up in the first delivery year, for example, or any of the prior delivery years to use to meet the delivery year requirement in that shortfall year. And in the last delivery year, we allow you to catch up up to the maximum contract quantity. So if you have several shortfall years, but towards the end you have several long years, you could deliver your RECs in the last delivery year and be paid by buyer for those RECs, but no more than the maximum contract quantity over the 15-year delivery term. In terms of collateral requirements, there is this term known as a collateral requirement. And this is based on the annual contract value. This annual contract value is simply the annual quantity under the contract times the purchase price. From the effective date through June 1st, 2019, the requirement is basically 50% of the annual contract value on or after this date, on or after June 1st, 2019, it will increase to the annual contract value. The collateral requirement is subject to a $50,000 minimum under each contract through the first 10 delivery years. We do provide unsecured credit for creditworthy entities, either the seller or the guarantor. If you're relying on a guarantor, then the guarantee must be provided to the buyer that is acceptable to the buyer for any unsecured credit to be granted. Unsecured credit is granted only to entities that are investment grade, and here we mean an senior unsecured debt rating of BBB minus from S&P or Fitch, or a Baa3 rating from Moody's. It must be at or above these threshold to meet the minimum rating to be granted unsecured credit. If it's an issuer rating, it will be discounted one notch. And the collateral threshold or the line of unsecured credit is currently at $2.5 million per contract. The standard form of the guarantee itself is provided as Exhibit B to the REC contract, and there are optional modifications that you can use at your discretion appended as schedules to the guarantee, and the letter of credit itself is found as Exhibit C to the REC contract. These documents are posted on the procurement website as standalone documents for your convenience. You can find also the modifications provided there as well. So with this, I will now stop and turn the time over to Dr. Lacasse, who will walk us through the practical aspects of the initial forward procurement process. Dr. Lacasse.
Thank you, Mr. Chi. Good afternoon, everyone. Before getting into this portion of the webcast, I will talk about the requirements, but also talk about the process by which you will submit information to fulfill those requirements. I just want to extend the same kind of disclaimer that we provided before regarding the REC contract, that in this portion of the presentation, we'll be talking about the RFP documents, and any statements that we make or any description that we provide are summaries only, and they're qualified in their entirety by my reference to the RFP documents that will be posted later on today on the procurement website and dated July 19th, so that bidders and sellers and all participants in the RFP bear full responsibility for reviewing and understanding the RFP documents once posted. So with that out of the way, the first slide here is the calendar of the events and the various dates in the RFP process, with the posting of the final REC contract, which was yesterday, and the issuance of the RFP in the webcast today. And tomorrow is the opening of the Part 1 window, and what that means is the opening of the time period during which you can provide the materials for the Part 1 proposal. And we talk about Part 1 proposal because, as Mr. Chi explained in the first part of the presentation, the proposal is provided in two parts, the Part 1 and the Part 2. And the Part 1 window ends at the deadline for the Part 1 proposal, which is also called the Part 1 date, which is also when the bid participation fee is due. And we mentioned in the first part of the presentation that the bid participation fee was maybe one element that wasn't done online, and that's certainly true in that it's not submitted through the application website that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, but you do have the option of using ePay for submission of the bid participation fee. Once the bid Part 1 proposals have been submitted, they get evaluated, and then participants get a Part 1 notification, which is the result of the Part 1 proposal, to let you know whether a particular project has been successful or not. And that's for the 14th of August, so roughly 5 business days after the deadline for the Part 1 proposal, at which point the Part 2 window opens, and that is the period of time during which you would be providing materials for the Part 2 proposal, with the deadline for the Part 2 proposal being the 23rd of August. And finally, the bid date, as was mentioned previously, is the 31st of August, and sometime between the Part 2 date and the bid date, which right now tentatively set for the 28th of August, would be training for bidders in the submission of the bid form. So you'll have an opportunity to prepare and present and provide and submit and transmit your bid form using the same process that you will use on bid day as a practice to make sure that you don't encounter any technical difficulties on the bid date itself. So we've talked about the proposals. We'll talk in more detail about that in the next few slides. Just kind of a word of caution that the proposal is also, as is the contract, project specific. So a proposal is for a particular project, And of course, there are individuals and entities involved with the development of that project. And we'll talk about the bidders and the sellers. And I think one of the things that we'll emphasize over the next few slides are which elements of the proposal, which documents are specific to the project and which are specific to the bidder or the seller. To give you an example from the first part of the presentation, we talked a bit about the bid participation fee and the fact that if a bidder is presenting multiple projects through this RFP, the bidder need only pay the bid participation fee once. So the bid participation fee is at the level of the bidder, if you will, while the proposal, which is for each project, is at the level of the project. So I'll be making that kind of distinction, explaining that a little bit more in the slides that follow. We already mentioned that going forward, the central source of information for the documents is through the procurement website at ipa-energyrfp.com. And in particular, on the left-hand navigation bar, you can get to the wind solar RFP through clicking the wind and solar RFP link, and you will then see three different pages. One of the pages will be the draft documents, the final documents, as well as the results once the bids have been received and once the commission has made a decision on the RFP results. You can also, from the website, get to a link to be able to register for an account. So as we mentioned, the submission of the proposal is done online. To be able to submit a proposal for a project online, you need to register for an account for that particular project. Registering for an account just means getting a username and a password that will allow you access to the online form by which you will provide information for your proposal. And there's two ways to get an account or register for an account if you have not done so already. One is on the left-hand navigation bar again, there's a link to the qualification forms at the bottom. If you click on that, you will see another link asking you to register here, and you can click on that. It will open up a number of fields asking for a company name, the name of a contact, phone numbers, and email address. You will then be requested to show your interest for one or several of the procurement events. So if it's for the wind and solar RFP, you can indicate that. And if you do say that that's the RFP you're interested in, you will also be asked for your number of projects. And again, given that a proposal is for a particular project, an account is also going to be for a particular project. So for a particular project, you will log in to a particular account with a different username that then you might have. If you're presenting multiple projects, then you will have a different username for each of your projects so that you can get to submit the information that's specific to your project. Now, alternatively, an alternative to clicking that link to register for an account is you can also email us at illinois-rfp@nera.com. The same information you'll be asked to fill in the form, namely your company name, the name of a contact, a phone number and email address, and then the number of projects for which you are requesting accounts. So you will receive login credentials then. As I mentioned, that's a username and a password, and you will receive a pair of username password for the number of projects that you will have indicated once you've registered for an account. For those of you who perhaps registered for an account but did not provide that information at the time, did not provide information on the number of projects for which you're intended to present proposals in the course of this RFP, you will have gotten from us an email requesting that information so that we can provide the correct number of accounts for you. In addition to the login credentials for each of the projects, you will also receive a guide to navigating and completing the forms. So that has a number of screenshots and a number of tips for providing, submitting information through the form and completing the form. Now, one tip or one warning that is in the guide that I'll talk about right now is the fact that, yes, there's going to be a different account, different proposal for each of the project, but if you are a participant that will be presenting multiple projects and therefore multiple proposals, those accounts are also linked. And that means that there will be a technical issue if you try to submit information for multiple projects at the same time using the same browser. So we definitely advise that you use different computers, different individuals perhaps, to provide information for different projects if you're going to do that at the same time. Now, again, addressing this comment to those of you that intend to present multiple projects through this RFP, one thing to note is that you will be able to tell which project that for which you are currently in the form or in the application website by looking at the top of the floating sidebar that will be visible once you're in the form, and that will tell you the username. So given that you'll have a different username for different projects, you will know at that point, you will see for which projects you're currently submitting information through the application website. All right, so that's kind of an introduction on getting the account information to be able to access the online forms. There's going to be two different online forms. The online Part 1 form for the Part 1 proposal is going to be open first. And once that is closed, once the Part 2 window opens, then the online Part 2 form will be opened. So I'll talk now about the actual proposal requirements. So for the Part 1 proposal requirements, there was an illustrative Part 1 form that was posted a little while ago providing most of the details of the requirements that you will have to submit to for each of your project. So in the Part 1 proposal, in terms of what is required at a high level for a given project, is going to be information about the project, information about the bidder and seller, and I'll get to that in just a second, potentially financial information, and finally the proof of the bid participation fee. So throughout this presentation and in the Part 1 proposal and the Part 2 proposal, we're going to distinguish the bidder from the seller. And that distinction is going to be important for those participants that are presenting multiple projects. If you have a single project, then the seller, which is the entity that will sign the rec contract if the project is selected through this RFP, and the seller should also be the entity that submits the proposal, that is the bidder. So the bidder and seller are the same to the extent that you're presenting a proposal for a single project. If you're presenting multiple projects, it is possible that the entity that's submitting the proposal and the seller, so the entity that will sign the rec contract, is not the same. And we'll provide a couple of examples on the next slide. So although the Part 1 proposal is required for each project, if you are presenting multiple projects, there will be some information that will be common to all projects. So, for example, there may be information about the representatives of the seller and the bidder that will be the same across all projects. Once that's the case, you will have an option in the online Part 1 form to tell us that you've submitted that information before for another project, and you will only need to submit it once. In terms of what you will have to submit for the Part 1 proposal, you will have to submit information through the online Part 1 form. So, for example, the name of a representative, the name of the seller and the bidder to the extent they're different. You will also be providing supporting documents, including what we're going to call inserts that are separate Word forms, and supporting documents in general and inserts in particular can be uploaded to the online form. They can also always be emailed to us at illinois-rfp@nira.com. So I'll dig a little bit more in giving you a couple of examples of when bidders and sellers should be the same and when they should be different. The place to start is to think about the entity that will be the signatory to the REC contract, so will be the actual seller of the RECs should your project be selected through this RFP. If a participant is presenting a single project, so this is the first example with bidder A, then if bidder A will be the signatory to the REC contract, then the proposal should be presented by bidder A. And that's the simplest case. It is possible, however, that there are affiliated entities or that there are several projects being presented by a participant through this RFP. And in that case, the bidder will be either the parent entity of the affiliated entities, or it can just be the names of all of the affiliates that would be the sellers if the projects were selected through this RFP. So in the second example, there are two different sellers, sort of two different entities. You can think about them as being project entities, so special purpose entities for each of the two projects that are presented through the RFPs, which in this example are called Seller C and Seller D. In that case, the name of the bidder could simply be the name of both sellers, so Seller C and Seller D. Another possibility, which is similar, is to have a number of sellers for different projects that are being presented, as in the third example at the bottom of the slide, where affiliated entities X, Y, and Z would all be the signatories to the REC contracts, would all be the sellers to the REC contracts if the projects are selected through the RFPs, and the proposal is presented by the parent company of all of these project entities or these special purpose entities. So in the case where a participant is presenting multiple projects through this RFP, we would be expecting that the sellers are identified in the proposal, so the signatories to the REC contract, and that the bidder that is identified is either the parent company of those affiliated entities or project entities, or that the bidder is identified by simply naming all of the sellers. So the first thing that you will be asked to provide in the Part 1 proposal is contact information. So contact information for the seller, again, that's the signatory to the REC contract. And to the extent that the seller is different from the bidder, then also contact information for the bidder. There will be a number of representations to be made, both in the Part 1 and the Part 2 from the seller. And to that end, you will name one individual, an officer of the seller, so an individual that can bind the seller and empower to take contracts. And you will name that officer, and that individual will make all the representations that are required in the Part 1 proposal and the Part 2 proposal. So you should make sure that that individual is available while you are preparing and presenting your proposal for the projects. You will also be asked to name a representative. So you can think about that as an individual who is acting on behalf of the bidder and the seller would be involved in the presentation of proposal itself. And that one representative, you will provide the contact information within the online form, but you can also provide contact information for three or up to three additional representatives. That's not required. But to the extent that you have various individuals that are involved in the preparation of the proposals, then we can certainly do that. And what that is going to mean is that our correspondence back to you in terms of the evaluation of the proposal, request for additional information, notification about the results of the evaluation of the proposal, are going to go to all the individuals, all the representatives that you will have named. So the representatives that's designated in the online form, as well as the additional representatives that you will have named, this time by completing a separate additional insert, which is a form in Word format that you can complete, and then you can upload to the online Part 1 form. Just a note that if you do have multiple projects and you have named representatives, then they have to be the same across projects. So for a given bidder, if a given bidder is submitting proposals for multiple projects, then all representatives must be the same. In other words, if you have three projects, there's still four representatives to be named, not 12. So that's kind of the team or the project team. Now, in terms of the project itself, you will be asked for information in the Part 1 proposal, basic information, the name of the project, the capacity, the date of the start of operations, if it has occurred. If it has not occurred, then the expected start of operation, and the category, meaning is it utility scale wind, utility scale solar, or is it a brownfield site PV project? And we asked that question in part because for brownfield PV projects, there are additional requirements within the Part 1 form, namely that you must indicate the program under which the project is regulated, and further information may be required in that regard. You will also be asked for a description of the site, including a complete address, surface area, and a description. There's various ways in which you can provide that description, including providing a map or simply providing a written description. So that's kind of the basic information about the project. And the second part of the information that we require about the project, we ask whether you have a fully executed interconnection agreement. If you do, then you can provide that fully executed interconnection agreement. Actually, we ask for the cover page and the signature page. And that's the end of the requirements at that point. But if you do not have a fully executed interconnection agreement, then what we ask are not kind of milestones necessarily towards that fully executed interconnection agreement, so the intermediate steps, if you will. Rather, what we ask instead is to provide evidence of site control and also to provide a description of the development milestones that have been achieved to date. So in terms of the site control, that means identifying the owners of the site for the project and to provide document to demonstrate site control. And of course, if you own the site, then that's definitely a demonstration of control of the site, but it could also be a lease agreement or easement. It could be an option providing you the right to lease or purchase the site. It could also be a letter of intent or a memorandum of understanding with the owners. And in that case, so in the case where the document that you will be presenting is a letter of intent or an MOU, then there are specific requirements of what those documents must contain, including information about the owners, information about what portion of the site they own, and specific statements that we're looking for in that letter of intent or that MOU. And there is an appendix to the RFP rules that specify those requirements. So not a form that you have to fill out, not a sample, so you can certainly use the documents that you would normally use in your usual course of business, but there are certain required elements of that document that we're looking for. And finally, as I mentioned, we ask that you describe the stage of development or the milestones that have been reached to date for the project. There are also a number of representations to be made in the Part 1 proposal, and those representations are made by the seller, which means that the officer of the seller for which you will have provided contact information that we talked about a little while ago will be the individuals making these representations. These representations, to a large extent, mirror the representations of the REC contract. So those are representations that you have to be able to make to sign the REC contract. So we're just making sure that you can make them at this point. So there's a number, and I'm not going through every certification here, but there's a number of certifications regarding the projects, including that meets the requirement for one of the categories, given how the utility scale, wind, utility scale, solar, and the brownfield site photovoltaic projects are defined in the Act, that locationally it's not located outside Illinois and outside the adjacent states, and there's a number of other certifications of the same type. There's also certification regarding the seller, so the seller has to accept the terms of the REC contract, has to be aware of the collateral requirements that exist under the REC contract, has to accept the RFP rules, and so on and so forth. So there's a number of certification regarding the seller. Those certifications are made through an insert. So again, that's a separate word form that is available through the procurement website that you can download and you can fill out. And given these will require a signature, you can print them and sign them and be able to then scan and upload the scan of the signed form to the online Part 1 form. So all participants will be providing these two inserts. So all participants will be making, all sellers will be making the certifications that I just discussed, and the full list is available both in those inserts and in the RFP rules. But there are also sellers in specific circumstances that have to make additional certifications. There's one for sellers where the project is located in an adjacent state, and there's also additional certification for solar projects, and that has to do for the solar projects with the representation that the system was installed by qualified persons. And talking about special circumstances, if a seller is under an agency agreement, then the next slide, please. Seller is under an agency agreement, then you should contact us, and there may be additional requirements that we will be providing you separately. Now, we discussed in the first part of the presentation that an unsecured credit line can be provided to entities that meet the minimum rating, and the minimum rating are provided here, BBB-, Baa3 from Moody's, BBB- from Fitch. So in the Part 1 form, to the extent that you have one, you have an entity that will be able to get the unsecured credit line, then we will make that assessment at that point in advance for you. So if either the seller meets the minimum rating, then you can provide us with that information and provide financial information to the extent that it's available for the seller. Or if there's a guarantor and the seller will be relying on that guarantor for purposes of the rec contract, and the guarantor can only be a guarantor if it satisfies the minimum rating. So if the parent company, there's a parent company of the seller, but the parent company does not satisfy the minimum rating, that parent company cannot be a guarantor. But to the extent that there is such a guarantor and the guarantor will be provided the unsecured line of credit, then we will ask that you provide those minimum ratings at the Part 1 stage so that we can verify that information. You can be sure that you can rely on that entity for purposes of the rec contract, and you can provide financial information to the extent that it's available for the guarantor. Finally, the bid participation fee. We've talked about that already, so I'll go quickly. So the bid participation fee is one of those items that's at the bidder level. So the bid participation fee is $500, but not per project, but per bidder, per party that will be submitting proposals for one or for multiple projects. And furthermore, it's only required if you haven't paid this fee already this year, either through your participation, the Block Energy RFP, or the DGRFP that were held in the spring. So the bid participation fee is due to the IPA by the Part 1 date. You can pay by check, payable to the Illinois Power Agency or through e-check. Full set of instructions is available from us at illinois-rfp@nera.com. One more thing for the Part 1. That's optional, but something that you should definitely consider if you're intending on relying on a letter of credit, either on a pre-bid basis for submission of the bid assurance collateral with the Part 2 proposal, or on a post-bid basis that you intend to use the letter of credit for posting the collateral requirement under the terms of the rec contract. So if you're in either one of those situations, you have an opportunity to submit your comments on the letters of credit. And you can provide comments or propose modification to the post-bid letter of credit for each company, Ameren, ComEd, or MidAmerican, that are provided as exhibits to the rec contract. Or you can provide comments or propose modification to the standard pre-bid letter of credit for each company. Those were posted last week and have been available for your review. So to the extent that you are intending to use these letter of credit, this is your opportunity to talk to your financial institution and see whether there are changes to the language that they want to propose and submit them to us as a red line to the letters of credit that are posted on the procurement website, and we will then provide an evaluation. And to the extent that a change that you propose is acceptable to the company, then it will become an acceptable modification that will be posted on the procurement website and that will be made available to all participants in the RFP. So that's the requirements. So the requirements, most of these requirements are basically on a pass or fail basis. You provide the information, you don't provide the information, and to the extent that you have satisfied the requirements of the Part 1 proposal, then you will receive a complete notice from us. And on the Part 1 notification, we will confirm that you can proceed to the Part 2 proposal. So there are no kind of additional information criteria that you do not see in the Part 1 form or in the RFP rules. So that's on the requirements side. On the process side, we talked a little bit about that already. So there's an online Part 1 form. You fill in your information through the form. To the extent there are additional documents, you can upload them there. You have additional forms for certifications or for special circumstances that are posted to the procurement website, and you download those forms, you fill them in, and you upload them to the application website. Now, once you're ready for a Part 1 proposal to be evaluated, then all you have to do is click Submit in the online Part 1 form. And to be very clear, if you are presenting multiple proposals, there's no reason to wait until all the proposals or all the projects, all the information is there. You can submit the Part 1 proposal for one project on one day and submit the Part 1 proposal for another project on another day. To the extent there are questions on the name of the bidder and that we have additional information we might ask, you may not get a final evaluation, but we can certainly evaluate your proposal the moment that you click Submit. When you do click Submit and we are evaluating the information that you're providing in that Part 1 proposal, you will be locked out of that account, meaning just prevented from making changes for that one project. You will still be able to be in the application website filling information for another project. So we'll proceed to initial review of your Part 1 proposal, and we will either let you know that all the information that we require has been submitted, or we will list any deficiencies, any clarification we need, any information that may be to that point incomplete. And we'll provide that initial review on the same day if your materials are received before noon, or the next day if your materials are received after noon on a given business day. If you do have deficiencies, you are generally given 2 business days to respond, at least for a first deficiency notice or first request for additional information. To the extent that you do provide a response, but there's still more information that is needed, then you will be given an additional time to cure, but it will generally be either also 2 business days or a shorter time. It will never be a longer time than 2 business days. Any notification that we provide, a deficiency notice, the evaluation of your response, all of the correspondence that come to us to the team for your project is going to go to all the representatives. So the one representative whose contact information is provided through the online Part 1 form, as well as the additional representative for which you would fill in the P1-1 insert. When we deliver documents to you, so that's really going to happen at the Part 1 notification stage, where we will provide not just the notice of letting you know whether or not the Part 1 proposal has been successful for a particular project, but also we will provide the bid form, and we will provide a guide, instructions on how to fill, encrypt, and transmit the bid form, details on the bid submission procedure, and confidential information for submission of your bids. And those documents are all going to be delivered via secure electronic file transfer. So those documents really are bidder-specific rather than project-specific in terms of the bid form and the instructions. So we're going to send that once to the representatives while the notices are going to be for each of the project of whether the Part 1 proposal for that particular project was successful. So that's the Part 1 proposal. Part 2 proposal, process-wise, very similar. So as I said, once the Part 1 is closed, Part 2 window opens. There's going to be an online Part 2 form. You're going to be submitting information through the form, uploading documents through the form, and once you click submit, we're going to evaluate the Part 2 proposal. So all of that is basically stays the same. The Part 2 proposal does include your bid, so it's really two packages. One that is due by the Part 2 date includes update to the contact information. So if the contact information for the representatives, for example, has changed, you will have an opportunity to change that. And by the same token, if you do submit the Part 2 form with the Part 1 information in there, which is what you're going to see when you log into the Part 2 form, then you are attesting that that information remains accurate and up to date. You will be indicating a bid quantity, an annual number of RECs across all companies. So that bid quantity is not binding, it's simply an indication. So indicate is the operative word here. And you will elect the form of bid assurance collateral. So bid assurance collateral is due with the Part 2 proposal, and it's generally a function of the capacity of the project, size in megawatts, and it can be provided either as cash or as a letter of credit, the pre-bid letter of credit. And if cash is elected, there's a number of additional requirements that we'll talk about in a little bit. And in addition to electing which form bid assurance collateral, you have to provide the bid assurance collateral. So cash or letter of credit, let me be a little more precise than that. It's going to be cash or letter of credit to each of the three companies. And you will also be providing information for preparing the contracts. We'll ask you to do that. And you will be providing some representations as well, some additional representations in the Part 2 stage. So for the cash or letter of credit, just to note that that's one of those elements that is going to be bidder specific. So if you're presenting multiple projects, you still have to, and you choose a letter of credit for each of the three companies, Ameren, ComEd, and MidAmerican, it means that you will present three letters of credit. So if you have four projects, it's still three letters of credit. It's not 12. So that's really at the bidder level. So the amount will be on the aggregate megawatts of the projects that you are presenting. So again, you'll be presenting the proposal by submitting information through the online Part 2 form, providing the certifications, which will be an insert again. And those are things like certifying that the bid that you're providing is binding, with the number of days for which it will be binding, that the information that you provide in the proportional is true. There's certain also provision on confidentiality of keeping information about the proportional confidential. You will be submitting the bid assurance collateral, either the executed letters of credit or transmitting and transferring cash. And then on the bid date, you will be providing your bids. That's kind of the second package of the Part 2 proposal. So on the bid assurance collateral, so there's been some updates which we've announced on the initial amounts that were in the draft requirements. So the bid assurance collateral, the amounts are for Ameren, Illinois, $1,600 per megawatt for wind, $4,000 for solar, $4,000 for ComEd. It's 4,000 per megawatts for wind, 10,000 per solar. For MidAmerican, it's not an amount per megawatt, but it's an amount kind of in total. So it's just a flat amount for MidAmerican. So the amounts per megawatt have come down from the draft requirements. What's also new is that it's different for each of Ameren and ComEd. The amounts are different a little bit. They are also subject to a floor and a ceiling. So the floor means that if the project doesn't aggregate up, for example, for Ameren, Illinois, to 35,000, the letter, the minimum of the letter of credit or the cash that is transmitted to Ameren is still 35,000. The ceiling means that if you have a lot of megawatts and you would actually be calculating an amount for Ameren, Illinois, that's over 120,000, then you don't need to provide any more than 100,000. So it's subject to a floor, but it's also subject to a ceiling so that you need not have a letter of credit or cash that exceeds 120,000 for Ameren, Illinois, or 300,000 for ComEd. So that might seem a little daunting. Just to note that we will provide very detailed instructions with the Part 1 notification, given the proposal that you will have submitted. If you have multiple projects in particular, we will provide the specific amounts that we expect to see for each of the companies so that you will have that prepared for you. Now, there's an exception to the amounts that I just quoted for the bid assurance collateral, which is that if a bidder is presenting projects that together total less than 2 megawatts. Now, the only way that's possible is if we're dealing with one or more brownfield site PV projects, then the bid assurance collateral is flat for each of the three utilities, 20,000 for each of Ameren, Illinois, and ComEd, and 10,000 for MidAmerican. So if you're presenting both some brownfield PV projects and the utility scale, then you're over 2 megawatts, and this exception doesn't apply to you. All the megawatts get rolled into the calculation of the bid assurance collateral according to the amounts per megawatt that you see in the table. So I mentioned briefly that if you are submitting cash, that means that there's going to be a little more requirements for that option. And what I meant by that is that if you are providing cash, then you need to provide certain documents to allow the utilities to return the cash to you after the procurement event is over. And that means that you will have to provide a W-9, and that's going to be for the entity to which the cash should be returned, and you will have to provide cash return instructions as well. There's also certain certification that you will have to make to ensure that you understand the conditions under which that cash could be drawn. Now, that doesn't apply for a letter of credit, for example, because those conditions under which the letter of credit must be drawn is actually in the text of the letter of credit. So for the letter of credit, just to note that, as I mentioned, there is a standard pre-bid letter of credit for each of the companies, Ameren Illinois, ComEd, and MidAmerican, and those are available for review. And if you are submitting a pre-bid letter of credit to one or to all of the companies, then that pre-bid letter credit has to be in that standard form or incorporate only those modifications that are acceptable and applicable to each company and that are posted to the procurement website, and will provide an initial list of those modifications. But again, a reminder that the Part 1 proposal is your opportunity to provide those changes that your financial institutions may want to propose on the standard form of the pre-bid letter of credit. We will provide fuller instructions for submission of the bid assurance collateral with the Part 1 notification. So I mentioned that we'll provide the amounts specific to your project. We'll also provide where to send the letters of credit, banking, wiring instructions for the utilities, et cetera. So everything that you need to know to be able to fulfill that requirement of the Part 2 proposal. So I mentioned that, talking now, going on to the bid, so the second package under the Part 2 proposal, that the bid form is going to be provided to you with the Part 1 notification, and the bid form will be the exclusive method for the submission of bids. If the bid for a project is not completely or consistently filled out, then it's not going to be evaluated. And the bid form, just to repeat something I said a little earlier, is the bid form is also kind of at the bidder level. So if you are submitting multiple projects through this RFP, then you would have a single bid form and you would provide all of your bids on that bid form. Now, there will be guides for you on how to fill in the bid form, not as it's very complicated. Basically, and we mentioned this in the first part of the presentation, the bid specifies two things, a price in dollars per rack, and then a number of rack, which corresponds to the annual quantity under the REC contract, or to be more precise, the annual quantity across all three companies. So the quantity to which you will be committing under the REC contract in aggregate across all the utilities. So once you fill in the bid form, then it must be submitted to us via secure electronic file transfer. We'll provide you, when I said we provide you with confidential information for the submission of your bid, what I mean is a username and password to be able to access that secure electronic file transfer and to provide that bid form to us. So we will be asking you to phone us so that we can confirm receipt of the bid form, and we will also be providing you with an evaluation of the bid form. Now, the submission window for the bids will be, and we come to that later, 8 to 12 on the bid date, and there will be a one-hour period, cure period, where we'll be evaluating the bid form, and to the extent that there are deficiencies in the bid form, that you will have time to correct those deficiencies. And after the 1 p.m. end of the cure period, then there will be no more opportunities to submit the bid form. So with the materials of the Part 1 notification, we'll include a step-by-step guide of how to fill in, encrypt, if you want to encrypt your bid form for additional security, submit and transmit through secure electronic file transfer, and also a backup method just in case on the day you have difficulty with the secure electronic file transfer. But what we're hoping is that you will participate in the bid training and that if there are difficulties, then we can solve them ahead of the bid day. So in terms of bid evaluation, there's a number of steps. So first, the bids that fail to meet or beat the benchmark for each category are eliminated so that what are kind of truly evaluated are the bids that meet or beat the benchmarks. The bids are ranked in price order separately for wind and solar, so for two project types, either until the target for the product for wind or solar has been met on an annual basis or until all bids are ranked. And in a third step, the winning bids are allocated to each company. In terms of the post-bid, what happens once the bids are in? So the bids, as I said, come in August 31st, which is the bid date, 8 to 12 p.m. You have to submit your bid forms during that window. The 12 to 1 p.m. is really a cure period. It's not to submit your first bid form. On that same day, we expect to notify you by 6 p.m. whether there are projects where you have bids that are identified as winning bids to the Inland Commerce Commission. Of course, we'll do it earlier if we can. Could be later, but at 6 p.m. on the bid date is what we're expecting at this point. So in the Part 2 proposal, we asked you to provide the information to prepare the REC contracts. So the REC contracts are prepared by the utilities. In the Part 2 proposal, you have a form where you can provide all the information that allows to populate the REC contract. And we asked you to provide that with the Part 2 proposal. If you haven't done so, then you'll have until noon of the day after we notify you that you have projects with winning bids to provide that insert for preparation of the REC contracts by the companies. 2 days after the bid date, or within 2 days of the bid date, then each of the procurement administrator and the procurement monitor submits confidential information to the Illinois Commerce Commission, and then the commission has 2 business days to accept or to reject the result of the procurement event. So assuming that the commission does accept the results, then the process continues on to contract execution and payment of the supplier fees. So the company will send to the seller electronically the partially executed contract documents so that the seller can countersign and send back electronically those REC contract documents. The seller still has to fulfill the credit requirement, and the collateral requirement is due within five days of the approval of the results by the commission. Just a little after that, so within 7 business days of approval of the results by the commission, then the payment of the supplier fees are due to the IPA. And just to note that there are a number of conditions under which the pre-bid letter credit or the cash, the bid assurance collateral, can be drawn, and one of those conditions is if the supplier fees are not paid by the deadline. That concludes the presentation portion of this webcast.